Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 22nd. Let the record reflect the time is 3:30 p.m. Today we have present Representative Wright, Representative Prox, Representative Carrick, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff will be assisting us today are Jordan Wright with House Records and Lisa Denny with the LIO, and my staff, Clark Pickford, Committee Aide to House Labor and Commerce. On today's agenda, we have two bill hearings. Our first bill hearing is on HB 47, and one second bill hearing on HB 93 that includes public testimony. Starting with HB 93, a bill drafted from my office, we set an amendment deadline for HB 93 and received no amendments. My intent for this bill is to hear public testimony and set it aside for a future date. We're going to open public testimony now and let the record reflect that Representative Ruffridge arrived at 3:31. So we will open public testimony. Please limit your testimony to 2 minutes. Do we have anybody in the room that would like to testify? Doesn't look like it. We have a Joe Young on the phone. Mr. Young, if you can hear me, please state your name for the record and begin your testimony. Thank you. Mr. Young, are you there?
Yes, my name is Joe Young, owner of Young's Timber Inc. in Tokalaska. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Go ahead and begin your testimony, Mr. Young. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Sumner, and the rest of the House Labor and Commerce members for allowing me to testify at House Bill 93. Again, my name is Joe Young. I'm owner of Young's Timber Inc. in Tokalaska, and I'm a big supporter of House Bill 93. Young's Timber Inc. has been in business since 1993 and has four different types of sawmills, producing a wide range of value-added products with 12 employees. Quality white spruce lumber is one of those value-added products. Young's Timber Inc. gets a lot of positive comments from its customers on the quality of its lumber it produces compared to the lumber quality that's imported from the lower 48 and Canada into the state of Alaska. Yet, Young's Timber Inc.'s lumber isn't graded or certified. Alaska spruce is comparative to Douglas fir in test loads, compression strength, and elasticity. House Bill 93, Lumber Grading Training Program, Lumber Grading Certificates, and the use of graded and certified lumber will not only greatly increase Young's Timber Inc.'s lumber sales, but the lumber sales of all Alaska value-added producers. House Bill 93 will create timber industry jobs and affordable rural housing. I recommend that the Labor and Commerce Committee to pass House Bill 93. Another note I have is the Alaska value-added producers need access to a reliable, steady, and long-term supply of Alaska state timber for success. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Young. Are there questions? No? Seeing none. We have a Helga Eng from State State Division of Forestry and Fire Protection online. Looks like it's indicated she's on online for questions. Are there any questions? No? Okay. And is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify? No? Okay. With that, we will close public testimony. Public testimony for HB 93 is now closed. We're going to set this bill aside for a future date. Moving on to HB 47 from Representative McCabe. My intent for this bill is to hear and set it aside for a future date. Representative McCabe or his staff can please approach the podium, put your name on the record, and begin your presentation.
That was my foot, not my knee. Thank you. Mr. Chair, can we get a brief at ease, please?
Brief at ease. Back on the record with Representative McCabe. Go ahead, Representative McCabe. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. For the record, I'm Kevin McCabe, representative for House District 30. And my staff, Buddy Witt.
Buddy Witt, staff for Representative McCabe.
So good afternoon, Chair Sumner, honorable members of the House Health and Services, Social Services Committee. Labor and Commerce Committee. Oops. For the record, my name is Representative Kevin McCabe, representing House District 30. I would like to thank you for this opportunity to introduce House Bill 47, the concept of direct health care agreements. I realize that many of you have heard this in another committee before, but I appreciate the opportunity to go through it again. One of the questions I ask myself is all the time is, what is a bill that is presented to me designed to do? What's the problem we're attempting to solve here? In this case, the answer to the question is simple. And it's really sad that this problem is prevalent in Alaska. We have some of the most expensive health care costs in the nation, according to the most recent data from the Kaiser Family Foundation, which was included in the bill packets. Alaska is ranked third among all 50 states and Washington, D.C. in total health care expenditures per capita at $13,642 per person. Only D.C. and New York are ahead of us. Alaska also ranks second in the nation in private health insurance spending per enrollee by state at $6,523 per person. So yes, Alaskans are under a heavy burden of high costs of living in just about every area, including healthcare. HB 47 provides guidelines for direct healthcare agreements between providers and patients. Direct healthcare agreements are not insurance. And we'll be stressing that throughout the bill hearing. Bless you.
Thank
you. HB 47 seeks to expand access to health care at a price point that may be more affordable for Alaskans. If you're not familiar with the concept, you may be asking yourself, what are direct health care agreements? Let me say again that they are not insurance. Direct health care agreements restore the heart of the physician-patient relationship. Gets doctors back to being doctors and nurses back to being nurses. With direct health care agreements, consumers pay a recurring fee directly to a provider for basic medical services. The monthly amount can vary depending on the doctor, the area, and type of plan. Direct means getting rid of the middleman, getting rid of the insurance company. Decades ago, health care was between the patient and the doctor with no third-party involvement in the process, and this bill seeks to restore that primary relationship. With direct health care, patient treatment is not determined by what insurance will cover, but rather by what the provider and the patient agree upon. As direct health care is not insurance, the care is based upon what is reimbursable, but on what is appropriate for the patient and their agreement. So Chairman Sumner and committee members, I'm by no means suggesting that allowing direct health care agreements are the panacea for burdensome costs in our state. I do believe, however, that it is one outstanding tool and a viable alternative to what has become traditional health care. Most of the states in our nation have recognized this fact, and I'm asking you to recognize it as well and help make direct health care an option for Alaskans by supporting House Bill 47. So with your permission, Mr. Chairman, my committee aide, Buddy Witt, will walk you through the sectional analysis as the next portion of this initial bill introduction.
Go ahead, Mr. Witt.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, this is Buddy Witt, staff to Representative McCabe. And as the representative mentioned, most everyone on your committee has heard this bill. It's a lengthy sectional, but I will go through it as quickly but thoroughly as possible. So House Bill 47 starts with Section 1. It's on Page 1, Line 4. Section 1 ends on Page 5, Line 9. And it's cut down into several subsections. I'll try to go through those fairly quickly. But subsection A of the section defines a direct health care agreement as a written agreement between patient or patient's representative and a health care provider to provide services in exchange for a periodic fee. This section also stipulates that Medicaid recipients under Alaska Statute 47.07, as well as those receiving assistance for catastrophic illnesses and chronic or acute medical conditions under AS 47.08. Anyone fitting into those areas are not eligible to enter into a direct health care agreement. Subsection B starts on page 1, lines 12 through page 2, line 19. This section specifies that agreements must contain a description of the healthcare services provided in exchange for the periodic fee and the locations where those services in the agreement are available. The agreements must also specify the amount of the periodic fee, the period of time covered by the agreement, and any additional fees that may be charged, including any and all cancellation fees. The agreement must also include contact information for the representatives of the healthcare provider designated to receive complaints. It has to prominently state that the agreement is not health insurance and state that the patient is not, therefore, entitled to protections under patient protections that are found in AS 21.07 and AS 21.36. Let me restate that. AS 21.07 and AS 21.36, and those would be the patient protections under healthcare insurance policies and the trade practices and frauds associated therewith. Subsection C directs that providers, and this is on page 2, lines 20 through 29, directs that providers must allow a patient to terminate the agreement within 30 days, and if the agreement is terminated, the provider shall provide a refund of the payments made under the agreement, less payments made for services already provided that are not included in the periodic fee. The provider may charge a termination fee equal to 1 month's cost of the periodic fee. There were some questions in the previous committee referral about cancellation and fees, and how could there not be a fee, but there is a fee, and we can go into detail in that section. But basically, this subsection says the patient has to be allowed to terminate the agreement within 30 days. But that upon termination, there could be some outstanding cancellation fees, and that any and all fees that are outstanding can be taken out of the refunded amount that's owed back to the person, the patient, is my understanding. And we also, while I'm at it, Mr. Chairman, I want to add that we do have Dr. Peter Diemer online, I believe, who will be able to answer committee members' questions as we go through this and get more in the technical legalese of the bill.
Mr. Witt, is Peter Diemer an attorney and a doctor? Or
He's an attorney.
Okay, thanks.
Did I say a doctor and an attorney? I apologize. He's an attorney. I'm not aware that he has any medical licenses. Subsection C directs the provider, Subsection D is on page 2, line 30 through page 3, line 8. This specifies that an agreement between the provider and the patient may be terminated by either party with at least 30 days written notice. The agreement must include the patient pay, that the patient pay the prorated periodic fee through the date of termination and any fees for services that may be outstanding. And the provider may charge a termination fee equal to 1 month's periodic fee. Subsection E on page 3, lines 9 through 11, states that the healthcare provider must provide a 45-day written notice of a change in the periodic fee, and that fee may only be changed once per year. Subsection F is on page 3, lines 12 through 14. The billing for the periodic fee occurs after the period covered by the fee. So you don't pay up front for the month of April. You wait till the end of April, and then you're billed. Subsection G, page 3, lines 15 through 20. An employer may cover the cost of the direct health care agreement. An employer may cover the cost of the direct health care agreement of the employee, but that still is not considered insurance or dealing in the business of insurance. Subsection H, page 3, lines 21 through 31, a provider can immediately terminate a direct health care agreement if the patient falls into one of three different categories. They repeatedly fail to show up for a treatment plan, exhibit behavior that is a threat to the safety of the provider or his or her staff, or engages in disrespectful, derogatory, or prejudiced behavior. Subsection I on page 4, lines 1 through 5. In this particular case, either party may terminate the agreement at any time if the other party breaches terms of the agreement. Subsection J of this section, page 4, lines 6 through 9. The patient protections under health care insurance policies and the trade practices and frauds located in AS 2107 and AS 21.36 respectively do not apply to direct health care agreements because they are a direct health care agreement is not insurance. However, direct health care agreements are subject to other consumer protections that we'll get to in towards the end of the bill. Subsection K, page 4, lines 10 through 22, a direct health care agreement is not insurance in any form and is therefore not subject to any regulation under the Division of Insurance. Additionally, a certificate of authority or license to market is not required in order to sell a direct health care agreement or services under a direct health care agreement. And then there are also definitions included for this entire section in subsection K. Section 2 of the bill now switches over to Title 45. This is page 5, lines 11 through page 6, line 4. And section A, subsection A says a healthcare provider may not refuse to enter into a direct healthcare agreement based upon any characteristic of a class of persons protected by state laws that prohibit discrimination. Subsection B states that a healthcare provider may decline to enter an agreement or cancel an existing agreement if the patient's care needs are beyond that which the healthcare provider can provide, or the provider does not have the capacity to accept any new clients. Subsection C states that a provider may use healthcare status as a reason for terminating a direct healthcare agreement only if the healthcare provider is unable to provide the services that the patient needs. Or in accordance with AS 2103-025-H and I. Subsection D provides definitions for the section. And then finally, Section 3 on page 6, lines 3 and 4, it adds violations of Section 2 of the bill to the list of unfair methods of competition and unfair or deceptive acts of or practices and the conduct of trade or commerce that are declared to be unlawful in Title 45. And that is the sectional analysis, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. Questions? Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Representative McCabe, we've talked a little bit about my interest in having a regulatory backstop to protect against abuse when and if this business model is successful and grows and potentially has outside investors come in. So I've drafted an amendment, which I think you've seen a draft of it, that would put that regulatory authority in the Division of Insurance. Number one, are you interested in potentially amending this bill to have a regulatory backstop beyond the AG, which I see as insufficient? And if so, do you have a better place that you'd like to see it than Division of Insurance?
So through the chair, Representative Fields, I don't think that we want to make this insurance in any manner, even putting it under the regulatory authority of Division of Insurance. And I have talked to Director Winghire about this, as well as the maker Dr. Erickson, mm-hmm. and Mr. Deemer, I believe, probably has an opinion on that about whether or not it's going to be taken over. One of the strongest things in here, I believe, is that it says that and I'll have to find it, maybe Buddy can find it, but where it says that it's owned by the providers. So that's not right. Hold on. Just give me one second.
Healthcare business.
So under the definition of healthcare business on page 4, it says healthcare business means a business licensed by the state that is entirely owned by healthcare providers. I think that provides a little bit of the protection from being bought out by a, a big conglomerate that you're talking about. I've had some discussion about the
private equity, sure.
Right. And buying out the hospice homes. Yeah. And I think this goes a long way towards solving it, but perhaps Mr. Deemer has a better idea of that. And I don't think he probably has seen your amendment.
Yeah. Okay. Well, through the chair, I might ask Mr. Deemer, what Representative McCabe and I had talked about is, I think this is going to be successful. There will be good local companies that own these direct health providers. And my concern is actually looking more down the road to when we potentially have outside companies and come in and buy them up and be less accountable to local people, less interested in the health of Alaskans. So that's an interesting alternate strategy. And I think my question would be, potentially, do we require that they be Alaska-based providers so it's not a healthcare providers, it's actually some national conglomerate. So that's one alternative. The other alternative is, I think I'm fine saying this is not insurance. We can keep that regulatory nonetheless in the division of insurance, given that Lori Wing-Hyer has a lot of expertise in that and someone like her would. Or if you just don't like the regulatory authority being in the division of insurance, is there an alternative place that you want to put it? I don't know. Department of Health. I mean, we can brainstorm out other ways of doing it. I definitely want to pursue a strong regulatory backstop for consumers. And just so committee members are aware, when the hospice industry took off, it was locally owned companies, nonprofits, do-gooders, basically. When they were successful, they were taken over by private equity. And what you saw is some pretty rapacious behavior where hospice providers would sign people up, not provide care, disenroll them if, God forbid, they actually cost money to provide care. There's a long record at this point of hospice providers fleecing the federal government. And I think my takeaway from that is you can have a really well-intentioned program, but you've got to think down the road to when it's owned by outside investors and how do we protect Alaskans. So that's the context for the questions. And Mr. Deemer, if you want to weigh in on that through the chair, welcome any thoughts or we can follow up later.
Mr. Deemer, are you on the line? Did you hear the question?
For the record, this is Pete Deemer. Through the chair, I did hear the question, Representative Fields, and I appreciate that question and that concern. I think that the bill sponsors concern about attempting to shift regulatory authority of a non-insurance arrangement to the division of insurance is well-founded. That said, there are three protections built into the existing bill that I would like to see your amendment or a comment on that. But the three protections that exist, of course, are the Department of Law, but it's also the individual professional boards, which are governing the licensed providers, which are the persons who are authorized within this bill to enter into a direct health care agreement. And that's a very strong protection. That's one of the reasons why healthcare business is defined the way that it is. To address your very concern that there would be outside non-licensed providers who would be owning a healthcare business providing services through direct healthcare agreements. Currently, that's prohibited under the definitional structure here. So what that result of that is that the providers who are licensed in Alaska are also regulated, heavily regulated, by their professional licensing boards. That's the second level of protection. Now, of course, the third, and it's one that we would never hope that anyone would have to resort to the court system, but it is there. This is a private contract. This bill is structured in such a way that it creates a safe harbor, that if the private direct health care agreement has at least these characteristics, it is considered to be a direct health care agreement and not insurance. Certainly, and let me speak to that for just one moment, because if there is, for example, a provider who presents a direct health care agreement that is outside of the safe harbor or has characteristics within that contract that are characteristics of contract of indemnity, which are insurance and are different, the director of insurance retains all of their regulatory authority here. The division of insurance through this bill continues to have that regulatory authority over those persons. they can enforce on people right now, and they would have the passage of this bill for introducing contracts which constitute insurance and which are not regulated. They would be able to enforce those on those persons just as they can now. So there are those three and four really levels of protection built within the existing bill, but I would welcome this, review your amendment and speak with you about that at a future date.
Okay, well, through the chair, if I might just follow up on that. I'm not persuaded that's a sufficient level of protection. I'll just go through it really quickly. You know, the Attorney General is in Alaska in a appointed position. It's historically a fairly political position. I'm not convinced that an Attorney General is as immune to political pressure, not this Attorney General, but historically in general the position, compared to, say, a division director, which is less political. I think the Attorney General also historically doesn't have that level of expertise in this particular area, healthcare. In terms of the board, I don't buy that argument. I'm sorry. I don't think that, you know, someone's peers who frankly are going to think, gosh, am I going to face a similar circumstance? I don't think that's protection. Now, civil action and contracts, that's worth exploring. So happy to follow up on that. I do have more questions, but I'll maybe take a back seat if other people have some.
So, Chairman Sumner, if you don't mind if I answer, maybe flesh out another portion of this a little bit.
One second, Representative McCabe. Let the record reflect that Representative Fields arrived at 3:42 p.m. and Representative Sadler arrived at 3:56 p.m. And Representative McCabe, if you would, please continue.
Thanks. So through the chair, the other protection, of course, is the clause that allows you to get out of it. So if you don't like the way the management is going, or if, for say, something like that happens where a bunch of out-of-state providers manage to get together and somehow buy it, within 30 days, you can get out. So the free market, in this case, is a lot better than in a hospice case where getting out of a hospice is a whole lot more difficult than just quitting a direct health care agreement. So I suspect that is probably the most overarching protection, if you will, is the ability to vote with your feet and find another direct health care agreement provider. With that said, I think Mr. Witt had a further comment.
No, yes, Mr. Not. Chairman. For the record, Buddy Witt, the representative kind of said what I was going to point out.
Okay, further questions? Representative Carrick can take the chair.
So, through the chair to Representative McCabe, is it the hope that individuals would pursue a direct health care agreement in addition to existing insurance they might have, or in lieu of existing insurance they might have?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, absolutely in addition to. In fact, insurance companies really like this because it gets them out of the health care business and gets them where they belong, which is in the insurance business. So certainly they would keep insurance for catastrophic things. There are many Christian insurance groups or other insurance groups that they have a high deductible, but they are there strictly for major health issues, big car accidents, that sort of thing that a direct health care provider can't necessarily provide. So since we introduced this bill in the previous committee, we've had some conversations with various insurance, because I was curious myself, you know, are we trying to compete with insurance companies here? And the answer is absolutely not. They like this because they don't want to be in the healthcare field. They would rather be in the insurance field, which is sort of their core competence.
Just a follow-up.
Go ahead, Representative Carrick.
And through the chair, and if your staff has an answer to this as well, do you have examples of Alaskan insurance companies that are supportive of this legislation, or have any weighed in thus far on direct health care agreements?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, no, the insurance companies that are based and operating in Alaska have not approached us with letters of support. I think the bill sponsor was speaking more generally, as this bill is actually, or this direct health care agreements and direct primary care agreements are now legal in the vast majority of the states. I think the last I looked, it was, oh, I have the numbers right here. Apologize, Mr. Chairman. Last I checked, it was available in 48 of the 50 states, 32 states that had passed legislation with another 12 that where this where the legislation was needed was pending, and then I had the final number of 48. 1,969 direct primary care clinics are currently practicing throughout the United States. And in the research of all the different areas of the studies, that I have yet to see an example of a big pushback from insurance companies. So I guess my answer is more anecdotal in that I don't have a direct answer for you. But based on the preponderance of the evidence that I'm seeing, there hasn't been any insurance pushback. As to your other question, and that was thank you for that first question, because that was an area of a lot of discussion in this bill's previous committee of referral. And with the members, we got the sense that there was a concern that with direct healthcare agreements being allowed and direct healthcare agreement facilities being allowed, that there would be a big movement from an already compressed insurance pool in Alaska into direct healthcare. And I can tell you that out of all the states, even the ones that are comparable in size to Alaska, which there are a few, I recognize that, but there is not the evidence in any of the states that there has been a giant shift. If anything, we have seen folks who currently have insurance add this as an addendum to their current insurance, or they make a change in their current insurance plan, add this on top, or we find a lot of folks who are not on insurance at all getting into a direct health care agreement, or in, depending on which state they're in, getting into a direct primary care agreement and being on some sort of having some sort of assistance with their health care. And there's a lot of evidence that shows that over the long haul, the more people that you have seeking health care and getting treatment, identifying chronic illnesses, over time, when you do see a bend in the cost curve as folks are getting treated and not letting things lag on until it's a catastrophic type of thing, or the treatment is more invasive and more intense. So that's within, I would point directly to the John Locke study. This was specific to North Carolina. That is in your supporting documents that were included in your packet.
Representative McCabe, it does appear you have invited testimony, and it appears that they're located in Indiana, so it may be getting late there. Did you want to have Adam Habig, I believe it is, with Freedom HealthWorks testify at this time?
Yes, through the chair. That is the one person we asked if the chair would be so kind as to give the gentleman about 3 minutes. He is from, as you said, the organization is HealthWorks, and he wanted to speak in support of the concept and this policy.
So, Mr. Habig, I'm sorry if I'm butchering your name. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Sumner. Adam Habig is how I pronounce it. Dialed in from Indianapolis, Indiana. Glad to join you today for the record. And appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of this bill and to share some insight that I've gleaned from my work in the space. And as you mentioned, president and co-founder of a company called Freedom HealthWorks. And we launched this company 5 years ago with the explicit purpose to help physicians who were desirous of moving to this new model, to help them land there and to help connect patients who were attracted to the model to these new practices. I come today to speak in favor of the bill, and I will say this on the record, that this type of legislation is critical to attracting physicians to the model and giving them the peace of mind that they're not wading into a minefield of regulation that they otherwise are trying to escape, that they otherwise are really disillusioned with when it comes to insurance billing. And as you mentioned, the practice, I call it the paint by number type of practice, where you practice by billing code rather than according to your training and your holistic method. So a little background on Freedom HealthWorks. This started as an endeavor here in Indianapolis, Indiana, to help really my parents, who were both longtime primary care practitioners, 40 plus years experience. They started at the beginning of their careers practicing independent medicine. They rose through the ranks as healthcare consolidated. They were part of a small group and then a larger group and a larger group. And finally, around 2016, their independent physician group was being purchased by United Healthcare. And they said, we can't do this any longer. We need an alternative. Can't pedal any quicker on the hamster wheel. So this is really a grassroots movement that we identified and built a company around helping physicians like them maintain their practices, their careers, and extend the livelihood of their careers. It really has one mission, and that's to give both doctors and patients, consumers, an alternative to what they see in the market today. It's not meant to replace anything. It's not meant to displace anything. It exists and coexists very nicely alongside the existing system. And what we've seen now, as we've expanded these practices that we support, now we're in 37 states supporting independent physicians who are engaged in this model, is that there's been this tremendous flourishing of different varieties of practice and different methods. Most will adhere to the membership model that you've identified. That seems to be the most prevalent model, where you pay a monthly fee and it's like Netflix. You have zero barriers when you're a consumer, you're a patient, to getting the care you need, whether it's in person, in the office, through telehealth. This eliminates all those barriers to getting that care. It pairs very well with people that have high deductibles with their insurance, because those deductibles do present a barrier to people. Every dollar you put between an individual and the care they need is a barrier. So this eliminates those barriers, and anyone is eligible. People enjoy these practices. Some of them, most of them will have insurance to pair with it. We do have some uninsured. They're welcome in the practice. Really, anyone is welcome. Everyone pays the same low price, and everyone enjoys the same great care. So wanted to share that, and happy to take questions based on what we've seen in other states as these direct care practices have flourished.
Thank you, Mr. Habig. Are there any questions? Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. Does your practice provide direct primary care or a much broader range of direct health care services? Thank you.
Through the chair, thank you for the question. My company, I'm not a physician, admittedly, my background is in finance and law. We support practices that are both primary care and what we would call specialty care. Most of them are primary care. That seems to be where this model really has originated, and there's just a greater concentration of direct care at the primary care level. But we do also support specialists who have migrated to this model.
Follow up, if I could. What, when you say specialty care, I'm not a doctor. Please educate us about what that means.
Sure. So if you look at the pyramid of healthcare, your primary care practitioners, your family practice, internal medicine physicians, pediatrics, these are the folks who form kind of the foundation of the healthcare system, right? These are your first points of contact, your frontline doctors. And frankly, 90% of Americans really only need a primary care physician every year. Beyond that, you have specialists, right? And the ones that really we've worked with in this model, your cardiologists, your ENT docs, some endocrinologists as well, they're kind of the next level. So if your primary care doctor can't handle it or thinks it's better seen by a specialist, they'll refer you on to that level. And this model has succeeded really in both contexts. I think there could be some specialties where it's not as conducive to this model, but this is it's an innovation that is flourishing really at all levels today. So it's growing in every direction.
Can I ask a follow-up? What is the income distribution to your patients and those specialty care direct health agreements, and is that different or the same as the socioeconomic profile of your patients in direct primary care?
Through the chair, that is a fantastic question. I wish I had that data at my fingertip. The primary care profile, last I've seen, and this was really a national study, the average household income, I believe, was around $90,000. That, of course, fluctuates. You have folks that are very affluent that join these practices right next to folks who are not. It's really open to everyone. I think that's where they found the national average. I can't speak to the specialist. That's a bit trickier because those patient panels tend to turn over a little more. With the primary care doc, you're normally establishing a relationship, and that's a long-term relationship. Unless you move away or there's some intervening event, you're going to be with that doctor for a number of years, which is great. There was a British Medical Journal article that came out and showed the direct correlation between long-term contact with the same physician and a tremendous decrease in morbidity and mortality. So we really encourage that. A doctor that really gets to know you at the primary care level is good for everyone.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think this kind of elucidates the difference between concierge specialty care and direct primary care, which may have different effects on the healthcare market, and is something I'm still trying to wrap my head around as we think about this bill.
Representative Seidler.
Thank you. If I could try and clarify the answer I got before I ask my question. Through the chair, Mr. Habig, are you speaking in, on behalf of the entire industry of direct healthcare providers, or just of those that your company has assisted? Because I want to make sure and put the answer you gave to Representative Fields' question about the average income in context. Does that represent the entire universe of direct healthcare participants?
Through the chair, yes. That is a study that I cannot cite on the fly, but that was a number that was attributable to all of the direct care industry.
Appreciate that. With your indulgence, Mr. Chair, can I ask my question? Through the chair, Mr. Habig, I'm curious. You said that your business was started to try and help other physicians navigate the minefields, the legal liabilities, and provide assurances to physicians who want to do this. What legal obstacles have you dealt with, or what kind of challenges have come to those physicians participating in direct health care agreements, despite your best efforts? And therefore, the question I'm going to ask is, does this bill sufficiently protect against and deal with those threats?
Certainly. Through the chair, I'll answer that question. When we started, we identified three core areas of objection or three core challenges that held doctors back from engaging and really innovating in the space. One of those was what we call legal kind of transitional risk, and that is everything from how the physician actually moves from one style of practice into the other, how that intersects with regulation. That there's somewhat of a minefield that they need to be wary of, and so we've plotted a pretty clear course through the weeds, as we like to say, for those physicians. This bill and bills like this that are now prevalent in the majority of states are incredibly powerful because they give physicians the peace of mind that this is not going to be they're not going to be surprised one day and find themselves subject to oversight or regulation that they were not aware of, and it lets them get back to basics, which these doctors are the prevalent type of practice that we see and that is common in the industry. It's a solo practitioner working on his or her own with maybe one staff member, two staff members, a very lean model. They just want to practice medicine. And the reason they're migrating to this is because they can leave all of the administrative headache behind, and bills like this give them peace of mind that they are indeed doing that. They're not going to be surprised when they step out on their own again, become an independent physician, that they don't have to worry about inadvertently stepping on a landmine when it comes to insurance.
That's one. You said there's two more? Through the chair, Mr. Habig, you said there were three specific areas of challenge. I think you enumerated one. Could you please elucidate the other two?
Certainly, through the chair. The first was what I call the legal and the transitional risk. That's a challenge that holds a lot of doctors back. That's daunting. It's very intimidating. The second is what I call business operational risk. And that is, once I get into practice, I'm now steering my own small business. And that's what a medical practice is when it's independent. So that's another level of risk that we help defray for physicians, and we've identified that that can hold physicians back. Case in point, we did a tremendous amount of R&D before we launched, and we had stories from docs about, you know, not knowing quite what a payroll tax was until they got a nasty letter about 6 weeks in. So there are obstacles there, easily overcome. The third risk is a little trickier, and that's what I call the economic risk. And so that's the risk that you launch a any business, and you need customers, and you need revenues, and you need to be embraced by the community. So those are the three areas. I don't know that they all apply to the bill at hand here today, but certainly that first one does. Certainly alleviating the legal concern and the anxiety that can create for physicians considering this alternative method of practice is critical.
If I'm with your permission, follow. And Mr. Habig, thank you. That's a good layout of the legal environment that these people would face. Someone who enters the business, or physicians in Alaska that would propose to enter this business under this bill, so they're cruising along. They've decided to get into direct health care. Is there any area that you've seen where the practices are challenged, once they are operating extrinsic to these three areas, or are those the only general areas of risk? What I'm trying to get to is somebody going to challenge the very foundation of this kind of medical practice and try and come at you wholesale?
Can you repeat that last part? I'm sorry.
Sure. I just want to, through the chair, Mr. Habig, I just want to find out if this bill is strong enough to take advantage of any other mistakes or weaknesses that you might have found out in practices under direct health care agreement bills in lower 48, anything that we need to make sure to prevent in our bill up here in Alaska.
Oh, certainly, through the chair. I like your bill. I do. There are, I say as a rule, I like to say give as much flexibility and freedom to the contracting parties as you can, as you feel comfortable doing. I know that there are certain things defined as I believe his buddy went through the details section by section. Those made sense. We like to allow these physicians and the patients they serve the flexibility to do certain things, to price, you know, according to the communities they serve. And believe me, we see an entire array of pricing depending on where these practices are set up. We see physicians who some will dedicate more of their practice to what we call charity care or discounted care than others. They have total flexibility, which is great. And we hate to infringe on that flexibility when it comes to them serving their patients. These doctors, they really do want to get back to serving patients the old-fashioned way, if you call it that, and try to clear the deck so they can do that is really our mission. I think those three areas I mentioned are the primary areas, the primary sectors of challenge and obstacles and risks. We've overcome that. There are practices flourishing all over the country today that have found their way through that minefield, if you will, those that work with our company and those that have done it independently. And, we say God bless them, each and every one of them, because just giving people choices again, it's a wonderful way of seeing the market serve the needs of individuals and let people vote with their feet and give them ideas, give them alternatives, give them choices. And I think everybody wins when that occurs.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Wanted to go back to and this question is actually, I apologize, for the bill sponsor. So if others had questions for Mr. Habig, I can wait for my question. Okay, to the bill sponsor. For the section, I think it's on page 4, line 25, and it was a question that I had in a previous committee of referral, where it says entirely owned by healthcare providers. And I think the intent of that was to ensure that there was an effort to have this be smaller, locally owned clinics and things of that nature. Do I have that correct, first of all? Okay.
I'm sorry, the clerk can't see a head nod, so I've been told that before, but through the chair, yes.
Okay, thank you, Representative McCabe. So when we go down to the definition in line 28, healthcare provider has the meaning given in AS 210-7250, That reads that it means a person licensed in this state or another state to provide medical services. And we asked a question in the other committee, and it feels to me like such an odd question that we have to define, but what is a person? So then I went through that effort. A person, according to AS 1181-900-B-47, means a natural person, but can also mean an organization, government, or government instrumentality. So how I potentially could read this is healthcare provider means an organization that provides medical services that's licensed in this state or another state. I liked the idea of it being small clinics and things of that nature, and I have a concern that there would be an opportunity for large organizations that provide healthcare services could be operating under direct healthcare. Or maybe that's a good thing. I just wondered if that's something that you could speak about, if I'm reading that wrong or if that's a concern that we might need to look at.
Certainly could be something. Through the chair, Representative Ruffers, it's certainly something that we could look at. It is not the intent of this bill to drive it into a big corporation. In fact, the entire bill, the entire intent of the bill is to get back to one doctor, one patient, nobody in between, and you know, the black bag style of doctors where, as we've said, he takes care of you, he or she takes care of you for your entire life, and when you come in and you're hobbling different or you look different, or he knows you, and it's not a big factory. So I'm comfortable if we change definitions for this to further define a healthcare provider and remove the for this particular bill. And in fact, there might be another bill that actually defines person out there right now. But I'm certainly comfortable changing that, and that might go a little bit towards resolving Representative Fields' question as well. So I'm comfortable with making a change like that. We can certainly look at it.
Okay, thank you.
So and through the chair again, it might be worth having Mr. Deemer, who has a law background, comment on that.
Please, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Mr. Deemer, could you opine on the definition of a person and what that can be?
For the record, Pete Deemer. Through the chair, yeah, I appreciate that question, and you can see that we're relying on some existing definitions within Title 21 as part of a bit of the evolution of this bill. Currently, it is structured to rely on a person being a natural person who is licensed to provide medical services. In Alaska, there are very few facilities they're actually licensed to deliver medical services. These types of services are all delivered by persons who are natural persons who are licensed through the professional licensing regulatory scheme. And if there are areas for enhancement within these definitions, I would agree with the bill sponsor that that certainly could be reviewed and looked for opportunities to enhance those definitions to ensure that, again, these are focused on natural people, human beings, who are the professional licensure, and that the healthcare business, again, that intent for the healthcare business to be owned entirely by the providers is for that purpose. That's it's a backstop against the corporate practice of medicine.
Thank you, Mr. Deemer.
I have some more questions for the bill sponsor, the appropriate
time. Representative Fields.
Thank you. Through the chairs, we've heard this, and you know, direct health is not regulated under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which means there's no guarantee for pre-existing conditions. I wonder, should we say in here it's different than PPACA because it's not insurance, but should we say a direct health provider may not discriminate against a patient when accepting them, or may not cancel a patient's coverage when a provider discovers that they had a pre-existing condition? is that something that the bill sponsor has contemplated? Thank you.
Seems to me that's through the chair, Representative Fields. It seems to me that that's inherent in the agreement. Maybe Mr. Witt has a better idea from the sexual analysis, but there's some termination language in there. I suspect that the agreement is, you know, if the pre-existing condition is such that the healthcare provider cannot provide for it, then he doesn't, in here, he doesn't have to take on that patient. But other than that, I'm not sure, I can't envision a situation. Are you saying so, like, somebody comes in with eczema and the doctor decides he doesn't want to take him on because he has something like that? Or are you saying if he comes in because he's got a prosthesis or something?
Through the chair, what I'm thinking is a patient might have a chronic condition that's real late, chronic and pre-existing condition, and the patient goes into a practice to treat a manifestation of that pre-existing condition, and actually treatment of that manifestation of the pre-existing condition is a positive thing. It helps the patient manage that condition. I don't think I would want the doctor to be able to cancel that patient because they discover, oh gosh, we're going to have to treat this patient once a month or once every couple weeks because of the pre-existing condition, if that makes sense. If you think it's inherent, I would sort of be inclined to just clarify that, but you know, I'm trying to think it through.
Thank you, through the chair. Buddy Witt, staff to Representative McCabe, for the record. Representative Fields, I think that is a very interesting. I would need to do some analysis on that. You make some good points. However, I would first of all point out in Section 1, we first, anyone who is getting assistance for catastrophic illness or acute or chronic medical conditions is not allowed to get a direct health care agreement first. So that takes care of that piece of that chronic illness pie. And secondly, we have provisions in the bill that state a medical provider is allowed to disengage from entering into a direct health care agreement if the patient's care needs are beyond that which the physician is able to provide care for. And I worry a little bit. I'd of course defer to the bill sponsor, and this is why I say we need to think it through a little bit, because I worry that the way the bill is currently stated, allowing a doctor to not enter into an agreement based on a care need that they simply can't meet, I worry that a pre-existing condition clause would conflict with that clause. And the idea of the direct health care agreement is that it is an agreement that takes care of the basic health needs, concerns that one would have, your annual physical, blood work, things of that nature. So, of course, I defer to the bill sponsor. Perhaps we can work that idea through a little bit more and craft a better idea of what the consequences of that would be.
Through the chair, yeah, let's do that. And, you know, what I'm thinking is there are kind of two groups of people who will be affected by this bill. One is the people for whom primary care coverage is supplementary to health insurance. I have, frankly, very few concerns about that. The other population is poor people who don't have insurance right now. So this becomes their de facto only health care. And I'm just trying to think through, how do we make sure that that group is best served under the structure of this bill? Mr. Chair, could I ask another question? Or I'll wait for Representative Sadler.
Representative Sadler.
I appreciate that. As often I'd like to address some question asked by Mr. Representative Fields first. I'm looking on page 2 of the bill, lines 14 through 16, that says that the direct health provider must have a statement promptly saying this is not insurance, does not meet any other federal mandate regarding health insurance. So if the Affordable Care Act has a pre-existing condition provision, the patient would be on notice that that would not apply. And then I look over on page 5 between lines 24 and 27 that says a direct health care provider may terminate a direct care relationship if they find that they do not have the wherewithal, professional ability to serve something. to use the example you're saying, so a person comes into a direct care health provider and says, I got a headache. Doc says, we can deal with headaches. Come as often as you want. After a couple months, finds out he's got brain cancer. Can that doctor terminate that patient? I'm sorry, no longer see that patient? I think the answer is yes, unless that general practitioner is a brain cancer surgery, brain tumor surgery. So I think there is a provision. I believe the concern you're evincing is addressed in the bill, I think. So what was my question going to be? goodness. I guess I was going to, the question is going to be to Mr. The gentleman who's with HealthWorks, Health Freedom Works. Is it standard practice for a physician to do a physical examination of somebody before they take them on as a patient to try and determine any pre-existing condition, or does a patient require to make any disclosure of any pre-existing condition? What's the practice?
Through the chair, Adam Habig, Freedom HealthWorks, responding. That's a fantastic question that is certainly left up to the physician to determine in their clinical judgment. My understanding, and I can speak for the majority of practices that we serve, those physicians will conduct a full-scale physical at least once a year, sometimes more often than that. I don't know of a situation where it is a requirement upon joining the practice. I've not been made aware of that yet. But my understanding is that fairly early in the patient-physician relationship, they will want to conduct a full-scale physical just to build that comprehensive medical history as they can then move forward with a care plan. So I think that's more best practice than a requirement, but we certainly would leave that up to the individual physician to determine when appropriate to conduct that.
And a follow-up on that, if I could. So I don't know, it would be up to a physician to say, as part of his contractual agreement, to say, I reserve the right to require you to disclose any known pre-existing conditions before I agree to take you on. Is that a possibility envisioned in this bill, that a contract could include that requirement?
Through the chair, if there was if the physician felt that was necessary to put that in writing, I could certainly see that being made part, maybe more of a policy, if it's not, you know, in the black and white of an agreement, part of a policy of the practice. From a best practices standpoint, I don't know a physician that would not want to engage in that sort of discovery early in that relationship. Because to speak to the pre-existing condition question, just in general, these are practices that are tremendous for people with pre-existing conditions, chronic illnesses. Those are the folks that really do need more frequent contact, more intense monitoring. We see a lot of people with chronic illnesses flocking to these practices, and physicians embrace that. These are doctors that want to that embrace that more extensive contact. And as you mentioned earlier, as was mentioned earlier, once you reach a certain level of familiarity with your patient, as a physician, you can, by sight alone, usually determine when something is wrong. One more point on that, in that thread. It was mentioned earlier that these practices have the effect of creating healthier patient populations, driving down the adverse events in the future. And I think that is because studies have shown that your primary care contact is driven up sometimes as much as 50-60% annually, more primary care contact, which drives down then your downstream events, your hospitalizations, your amputations, things of that nature that metastasize and erupt when you let chronic conditions especially go untreated and unmonitored.
Thank you, sir.
Could I ask a follow-up on that point?
Representative Fields and then Representative Carrick.
I was hoping through the chair that the testifier could elaborate on. It was interesting to hear, actually, a lot of people have chronic conditions that are treated. And is this something like diabetes where you're helping people manage it, or could you give us some examples to understand that better? Thank you.
Certainly, through the chair, I'll respond. Diabetes is a major condition that is job one for many of these practices. Hyperlipidemia, hypertension, asthma, certain mental illnesses like depression. Really, your top 10 chronic illnesses are really well tailored for the majority of these practices. And I'll say the majority. This, I guess goes to the point of when a doctor feels it's appropriate to render treatment or not. Certainly, you wouldn't walk in and expect diabetes treatment from a pediatrician, right? That physician would say, I'm not the right venue for that. But for the majority of your family practice, internal med doctors, you know, this model frees them from the time constraints and the administrative burdens so that they can focus more time and energy on those conditions that demand a higher level of attention. And I think that's what's attractive to both the physicians who want to practice that sort of medicine and the patients, even the caregivers who are bringing perhaps their mother, their parents, or grandmother into these practices, is they can get that higher level of intensive care with those frontline chronic conditions at these practices.
Thank you.
Through the chair, Buddy Witt, staff to Representative McCabe for the record. With chair permission, can I ask Mr. Deemer to expound upon a question? I believe it was from Representative Sadler concerning page 5, lines 24 through 27, concerning the ability to terminate a direct health care agreement with an existing patient. Can we ask Mr. Deemer to chime in on that?
Mr. Deemer, if you heard that, you could weigh in on that, please.
Thank you. This is Pete Deemer. I believe that the question was presented originally by Representative Fields, and the current bill does address this issue of termination solely for the reason of a patient health status, and that is on page 5, line 24 through 27, and it restricts that termination. A healthcare provider can only terminate a direct healthcare agreement with an existing patient based on the patient's healthcare status only if the healthcare provider is unable to provide the patient with the healthcare services patient requires. So that's exactly what the embedded testimony has been speaking to. What, you know, this is a different concept. You know, pre-existing condition is an insurance-driven concept. Direct healthcare agreements are not insurance. And while we might be thinking that patients have pre-existing conditions, of course they do. But we're talking about the relationship between the provider and the patient here. And the provider has to have the capacity, has to have the professional capacity to treat the patient. It's not a question of whether or not an insurance company should be obligated to pay money for the treatment of a patient for a pre-existing condition who would then be treated by the appropriate provider. Here, it's a question of whether or not the provider has the professional capacity to treat the patient. So it's a different concept. And so the reason for this restriction, though, is this protection is built in to those lines at 5, page 5, 24 through 27, is to address, it's a consumer protection, to address the idea or the concern, perhaps the Representative Field is expressing, of a provider who would be tempted to terminate a patient for, quote, overconsumption of services, right? Because a direct healthcare agreement within the safe harbor that this bill presents is a defined menu of services for a defined periodic fee. And this section is a protection, the patient protections in the patient protection section of Title 45 to prohibit a provider from terminating based upon patient healthcare status or health condition status unless they can't provide the service. So this is the backstop. This is to prevent the provider from attempting to, you know, shed off parts of the panel, the patient panel, or the particular patient that is, quote, over-consuming the services. That would be prohibited.
We'll go Representative Carrick, then Representative Sadler, then Representative Fields.
Through the chair, I actually have another question, kind of maybe bridging off of that a little bit. In Section 1, Parts I, H and I, the testifier earlier said that, or likened this type of direct health care agreement to a Netflix membership, and I kind of see it a little bit like a gym membership. But unlike a gym membership, where in Section H, we say, a provider can immediately terminate a direct healthcare agreement if a patient repeatedly fails to follow a treatment plan. Nobody takes away my gym membership if I don't actually go to the gym. So And in Section I, we say either party can terminate the agreement at any time if the other party breaches terms of the agreement. So the question I have is, are these agreements purely based on the rates being paid and the time frame under question, or do they involve agreements to the actual treatment as well? In which case, again, this is very much similar to a membership, but also very different in the sense that I wouldn't want to see Alaskans suddenly being cut off because their provider, for example, tells them you need to lose 10 pounds for your health, and then they don't lose 10 pounds. Can you just elaborate a little bit on that, or perhaps the invited testimony can?
Thanks. So through the chair, Representative McCabe here, Representative Carrick, I suspect that's a Mr. Deamer question. Seems like a little bit of a legal question, but certainly I don't think it's meant to be lose 10 pounds or else don't come back. I think it's it has some different medical implications. And remember, these are agreements. So the agreement will be laid out between the patient and the doctor before he ever signs. They come to an agreement, they sign. I think somebody said these are a defined service in the agreement for a defined amount of money. And they come together and they make an agreement. It's not insurance in the classic sense of the deal. That's kind of why I looked at Representative Fields a little bit weird, because a pre-existing condition has to do with insurance. It really doesn't even fit into this kind of model. A pre-existing condition is the insurance company wants to know, or they won't provide insurance for you if you have a pre-existing condition that's going to cause them to have to pay you later, pay money to you later. The doctors here want to fix you. They want to have under this agreement, they want to have a relationship with you. So if somebody comes to the doctor with a pre-existing condition, I think, such as diabetes, as Mr. Higbee mentioned, that's what this is set up for, is to fix that, to help them find their way through that. So, and we struggle with this all the time when we're talking about it. We try to put it in the insurance box, and it's just not insurance. So, hopefully Mr. Deamer, can expound on your question about the gym membership sort of thing, or
I guess Mr. Deamer, go ahead if you have some input on that.
Thank you, through the chair, Pete Deamer, and I appreciate this question. We're looking specifically at subsection H, and it's important to remember the context of this bill. This bill fits into existing Alaska statutory and regulatory paradigm for the professionals. And let's just use physicians as an example because it's convenient. Physicians are heavily regulated under their professional regulations right now. In fact, if you look at Alaska Administrative Code 12 AAC 955A alpha, that's a provision of Alaska Administrative Code that adopts the American Medical Association 2016 Code of Medical Ethics. And it imposes it upon all licensed physicians in the state as a regulation. So the physicians must follow the AMA Code of Ethics. And the AMA Code of Ethics has many guidelines, and it has an interpretive guidance as well. But that Code of Ethics is what is controlling the physician-patient relationship right now. Physicians aren't public utilities. They have certain rights to determine which patients they desire and have the capacity to treat. And the AMA Code of Ethics is the governing rule right now that controls the formation and the termination of a physician-patient relationship. But because the direct healthcare agreement is new, it's a different concept, crafting this bill, I thought along with the sponsor that the patient should be put on notice of some of these elements that could result in the termination of a direct healthcare agreement. They may not be aware of them, even though they apply right now, the physician-patient relationship between every physician and every patient in Alaska today. So these sections, H1, 2, and 3, are all based on AMA guidance and the 2016 Code of Ethics, and they're verbatim lifted from the interpretive guidance that idea that this relationship is special, and most patients today don't realize that the 2016 Code of Medical Code of Medical Ethics applies to their physician and allows for this type of relationship termination. And so we thought it best, as a consumer awareness and a protection, to place it in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Deemer. And I'm going to pass the gavel to Vice Chair Ruffridge for a few minutes and Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And I got a question which kind of addresses a couple issues here. And my question is, there are provisions for allowing a patient to exit a direct care-health relationship and allow the provider, this is on page 2, lines 3 through 6, 3 through 13, and then also on page 3, lines 23 to, I guess, back, continuing all the way down to page 4, line 6. The basic question is, who decides if there's a difference of opinion? If the healthcare provider says, you know, I don't think I'm qualified to treat you. And the patient might say, well, I think you're in. Or if someone, if the doctor says, you know, I think you are failing to comply, or you're being unruly, or you're being derogatory or disrespectful, I think I'm going to cut you loose. And if the patient says, I don't think I am, does the physician hold all the cards in this equation? I mean, who decides who's the final authority? Is there any right to appeal? And if so, to whom? I'm not sure. That'd be a question for the attorney. And I spent too many hours in 182s. If you could speak up a little bit, Mr. Deemer, so I can hear you better.
For the record, Pete Deemer, and that's a fantastic question. And the patient does have a right. Today, again, this bill is designed to fit into the current regulatory framework. And the patient does have the right to make that complaint to the medical board in the case of a physician. And so if they feel as though that they've been inappropriately terminated, or the physician has in some way violated any of those regulations, including the 2016 Code of Medical Ethics, then they can file a complaint, and they will have a consumer complaint and protection process within that professional licensing board. That was one of the four areas of patient protections that we outlined in response to Representative Fields' question. First being Department of Law, second is the regulatory boards, third, of course, the court system, fourth is then the overriding Division of Insurance in the event that, you know, someone is engaging in the actual unlicensed practice of insurance. So there is a mechanism for the patient to address that concern.
I guess can I follow up briefly?
Follow up.
I'm glad to hear that, and I appreciate being reminded of the current state of things. I do know, however, that the professional boards have a tremendous burden of investigation. It's a big cost for them and for others. So while that level of appeal is available, it could be a little bit tough to get swift justice from the medical board or any board. So, but noted. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Fields.
Thanks, through the chair. Kind of wanted to move on or move back to this topic of concierge medicine that tends to be higher end versus direct primary care. And through the chair, just wanted to ask the sponsor, it sounds like your goal here is direct primary care, but the bill also allows for broader direct health services. Is that an accurate characterization?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, so sure. I mean, we have to allow the doctors the flexibility to say, I can't deal with this, or your condition is too serious. I've done all I can for you. You need to, we need to refer you to a higher level, whether it be a heart doctor or somebody that has a bigger understanding. I think that was one of the reasons, as Mr. Deemer said, we tried to fit it all into statute so that they could have that opportunity.
Okay. Follow up, and it sounds like under this bill, direct health beyond primary care is permitted. Is it your intent to open it up to what could become kind of a high-end concierge market in addition to primary care, or are you really focused on the primary care?
Through the chair, no. At this point, we're only focused on the primary care, and I'm not so sure. Mr. Witt and I have been talking about the difference between direct primary care and direct health care, because they seem places in this bill to be used interchangeably, and such as page 5, line 11, it says direct health care agreements. What this bill really is talking about is direct primary care agreements.
Okay.
So
I guess through the chair and maybe a collective conversation, I feel like it is an important distinction because we do have in the lower 48 concierge medicine that you could argue sort of takes physicians out of the market of serving a broader patient population. And I think I really support the direct primary care. I do have some concerns about taking physicians out of the market serving working class Alaskans. And if the intent is primary care, maybe it's worth considering kind of clarifying and focusing that. And, you know, maybe that's going to take further conversation, but I would be interested in that.
So would we. Thank you. Through the chair. Absolutely. So it's our intent is not to go down the concierge medicine. It's a completely separate, in our opinion, from this. Our intent is the doctor patient small, because we have read many studies, as Dr. Erickson says, and that say that if you can, right now, people that have a $5,000 deductible and they have something wrong with them and they haven't met the deductible this year, they don't go to a doctor. They just don't, because it's going to cost them money. That even the concierge thing, they're going to have to pay until they reach their deductible, right? And that's insurance. Under this agreement, if they have a cut or a sprained ankle or something like that, they could just go to the doctor. And the better and the more often you see your doctor, the more familiar he is with you, and it actually lowers the cost for the insurance companies. It lowers the risk for you. Blood pressure is a big one. We mentioned that. You know, if you have a doctor that's maintaining, watching your blood pressure, keeping an eye on, I think they call it the well-controlled. So you and your doctor are controlling your blood pressure or your thyroid, and he sees you and you get the medicine. That's what this is designed for. It's not, you know, the concierge thing is a totally separate thing, if you will. So
thanks, Mr. Chairman. I like that, and maybe I'll just follow up with Ledge Legal and talk to him and work with the bill sponsor on that. And I'm going to stop talking so we can get to 93.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, we will set aside HB 47. That concludes our business today. We will adjourn. Let the record reflect. The time is 4:53 p.m.